All right, are you ready to dive into a real historical mystery?
I'm always ready for a good mystery.
This one has it all.
What's that?
Ancient texts,
Ooh.
archaeological discoveries,
Okay.
and even some scholarly debates that have been raging for centuries.
Sounds like we've got our work cut out for us.
You got it.
I'm in.
So the big question we're tackling today is the dating of the Exodus.
Ah, one of the pivotal events in biblical history.
Right, but pinpointing when it actually happened.
Yeah.
Well, let's just say that's a bit of a challenge.
It's one of those questions that has puzzled historians and archaeologists for ages, and
Exactly.
there's no easy answer.
We're going to be examining the evidence for both the early date, that's the 15th century BCE,
Okay.
and the late date, which puts it in the 13th century BCE.
So which side are you leaning towards? Early or late?
Honestly, I'm going in with an open mind.
That's the best way to approach it.
I'm eager to see what the evidence reveals.
Me too.
It's like a historical detective story.
You got it. We've got clues to analyze, theories to test, and hopefully by the end of this deep dive, we'll have a better understanding of this ancient event and its place in history.
Awesome. To kick things off, let's start with the arguments for a later date, the 13th century BCE.
Sounds good.
One of the sources you sent over mentioned Exodus 1:11, where it talks about the Israelites building the cities of Pithom and Ramses in Egypt.
Right, those cities.
It seems like that connects pretty directly to the 19th dynasty pharaohs named, well, Ramses, right?
It's certainly a tempting connection, isn't it? I mean, on the
Right.
surface, it seems like a slam dunk for the late date camp.
So what's the catch?
Well, recent archaeological digs have actually shown something really interesting.
What's that?
They found evidence of construction in those cities going all the way back to the 18th dynasty.
Really?
Yeah.
So before the Ramses pharaohs, we usually associate with the Exodus.
Exactly. It throws a bit of a wrench into the argument, doesn't it?
It definitely makes things more complicated.
It means we can't just assume that those cities were built exclusively by the Israelites under the 19th dynasty pharaohs. There's a longer history there, a history that we're still piecing together.
So it's not as simple as just matching up names in the Bible with names of pharaohs.
Nope, not at all. It's a reminder that archaeology can sometimes challenge our assumptions and force us to rethink our interpretations.
It makes you wonder what other surprises might be lurking beneath the surface, waiting to be uncovered.
Oh, I'm sure there are plenty more where that came from. Archaeology is full of unexpected twists and turns.
All right, so we've got some city-building intrigue.
Right.
What about the Israelites themselves?
What about them?
Did they leave any traces in Canaan that could help us figure out whether they arrived early or late?
Ah, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
It is.
And unfortunately, the archaeological evidence isn't always clear-cut.
Like a blurry photograph.
Kind of.
We can make out some shapes, but the details are fuzzy.
Exactly. Now, one archaeologist who did a lot of digging in Transjordan, Nelson Gluck, he didn't find any solid evidence of a settled Israelite population there before 1300 BCE.
And that would seem to support the idea of a later entry into Canaan.
Right, which aligns with a 13th century exodus.
So, 1 point for team late date.
Well, not so fast.
Oh.
Is there another twist?
Maybe. What is it? While Gluck's findings are important, we have to remember that archaeology is about what we find, but also about acknowledging what we haven't found yet.
Right.
The absence of evidence doesn't necessarily mean the Israelites weren't there before 1300 BCE.
They could have left behind very little, or maybe we just haven't found it yet.
Precisely. It's a good reminder to be cautious about drawing definitive conclusions from negative evidence.
It's like trying to prove a negative. Always a tricky business.
It is.
All right, so we've got some city-building clues, a lack of clear Israelite settlements before 1300 BCE. What else points toward a 13th century exodus?
Well, there's another piece of the puzzle that's pretty intriguing. Destruction layers.
Destruction layers.
Yeah, in Canaanite cities.
What do you mean? Several cities that are mentioned in the book of Joshua as being conquered by the Israelites. Places like Lachish,
Yeah.
Bethel, Hazor, Debir. They all show these layers of destruction dating back to around 1250 to 1200 BCE.
Huh. That does seem to line up with the timeline for a later exodus.
Right, but here's the thing.
What that?
Just because there's destruction doesn't automatically mean the Israelites were the ones who caused it.
That's a good point. I mean, Canaan was a pretty volatile place back then, right?
It was. There were all sorts of conflicts and power struggles going on.
So how do we know for sure that those destruction layers are connected to the Israelites?
Well, the Bible does talk about the Israelites conquering Canaanite cities, but it only specifically mentions three cities that they burned.
Three cities,
Jericho,
okay.
Ai, well, yeah. and Hazor.
So attributing all those other instances of destruction to the Israelites would be kind of jumping the gun.
Exactly. We need more than just a general correlation in time. We need more specific evidence to make that connection.
It's a good reminder that we have to be careful about imposing our own narratives on the past.
Absolutely. We need to let the evidence speak for itself, even when it's messy and doesn't fit neatly into our preconceived notions.
All right, so we've got some potential clues, but each one comes with its own set of complexities and caveats. I'm starting to see why this whole Exodus dating debate has gone on for so long. But before we move on to the early date arguments, there's one more thing we have to discuss on the late date side. It's that inscription from Pharaoh Merneptah, right?
Ah, yes. The Merneptah Stele. We can't talk about the Exodus timeline without mentioning that.
I was wondering when that would come up. So remind me, what's so important about this stele?
Well, for one thing, it dates back to around 1220 BCE.
Okay.
And it's the first time we see the name Israel mentioned outside of the Bible.
Really? So it's like an independent confirmation that they existed?
Exactly. And what's even more significant is that it places them in Canaan.
Already in Canaan by 1220 BCE. It seems pretty late.
It does, doesn't it?
It definitely throws a wrench into the timeline if we're considering an early date for the Exodus.
It does indeed. This stele gives us what we call a terminus ad quem.
Which means?
It's a fancy Latin term for the latest possible date something could have happened. In this case, it means the Exodus couldn't have happened any later than 1220 BCE if the Israelites were already settled in Canaan by then.
So even if we can't pinpoint the exact year of the Exodus, we know it couldn't have happened after this inscription.
Exactly. It sets a hard limit on the timeline. And if we factor in those traditional 40 years of wandering in the wilderness.
Before entering Canaan.
Right. That pushes the Exodus back to no later than 1260 BCE.
Wow, that Merneptah stele really shakes things up, doesn't it?
It does. It forces us to reevaluate the evidence and consider the implications for both the early and late date arguments.
It makes me wonder what other historical surprises might be out there, just waiting to be discovered and debated.
Oh, I sure there are plenty. That's what keeps history so fascinating. There's always something new to learn, something old to re-examine, and something to spark our curiosity.
Well, now that we've thoroughly explored the late date arguments, I'm eager to dive into the evidence supporting an early Exodus, perhaps in the 15th century BCE. What have you got for us on that front?
Oh, we've got some compelling clues to explore. Shall we take a journey back to the time of Thutmose III?
Let's do it. I'm ready to delve deeper into this historical mystery.
Buckle up. It's going to be a fascinating ride. Welcome back to our deep dive into the Exodus timeline.
It's like we're on an archaeological dig, sifting through layers of history.
That's a great analogy.
What else can we find?
We've just explored some pretty compelling arguments for a late date, but now it's time to turn our attention to the evidence that supports an earlier Exodus, maybe in the 15th century BCE.
All right, I'm ready for a different perspective.
Where do we even begin?
Where should we start?
Well, how about we start with the Bible itself?
Sounds good.
There's a passage in 1 Kings 6.1 that states that Solomon began building the temple in Jerusalem 480 years after the Exodus.
Okay.
And since we have a fairly solid idea of when Solomon was around,
we can just do the math and figure out when the Exodus happened.
Exactly. Using the widely accepted date for the start of Solomon's reign, which is around 966 BCE,
yeah,
a simple calculation takes us back to 1446 BCE for the Exodus.
Huh. That seems pretty straightforward.
Right.
Case closed for the early date.
Well, not so fast. Hold on.
What is it?
Those who favor a late date, they've got a different interpretation of that 480 years.
How so?
They argue that it might be a symbolic number, representing 12 generations of 40 years each.
Ah, so it's not meant to be a precise literal year count.
More of a symbolic way to represent a long period of time.
Got it.
But even if we accept that interpretation, there's a bit of a snag.
What's that?
A generation is typically closer to 25 years.
Not 40.
Not 40, right. Mm. And if we use a more realistic figure, that date actually shifts closer to the late date range.
So even the attempt to reinterpret the 480 years doesn't completely rule out a later Exodus.
It doesn't. It just adds another layer of complexity to the debate.
It's like trying to solve a Sudoku puzzle where some of the numbers are smudged.
I like that analogy.
There are multiple possibilities, but it's hard to know for sure which one is correct.
Precisely. All right, so we've got this one biblical text that could support an early date, but it's open to interpretation. What else might point to a 15th century Exodus Anything in the Egyptian records from that period?
Ah, that's the question, isn't it? Is there anything in the Egyptian records that might shed some light on this?
Well, there is one intriguing possibility. Remember Thutmose III, the pharaoh whose long reign seemed to fit better with the biblical account of Moses' lifespan.
Yeah, Seti II's time on the throne wouldn't have been long enough for all those events to take place.
Right, it's like trying to fit a square peg into a round hole. The timeline just didn't work.
But is there anything else about Thutmose III that might be relevant to the Exodus beyond just the length of his reign?
Well, this is where things get really interesting. During Thutmose III's reign, Egypt went through a period of major religious upheaval.
Religious upheaval?
Yeah, he promoted the worship of a sun god named Aten, and he was trying to elevate Aten above all the other gods.
Hmm, that rings a bell. Isn't there something similar in the Exodus story?
Yeah.
Like the Israelites' monotheistic beliefs?
Exactly. You're on the right track. The Israelites' devotion to Yahweh as the one true God would have been directly at odds with this new religious order that Thutmose III was trying to establish.
So you're suggesting a possible connection between this Aten-focused religion and the events leading up to the Exodus?
Mm-hmm.
Like, maybe the Israelites' resistance to this new religious order played a role.
It's definitely an intriguing possibility.
It is. It's like a historical thriller with political and religious intrigue.
Right.
But is there any hard evidence to back this up? Or is it just a theory?
Well, that's where things get a bit murky. Unfortunately, most of what we know about this period comes from Egyptian sources, and they might not necessarily reflect the Israelites' perspective.
That makes sense. It's like trying to piece together a puzzle with only half the pieces.
You got it. It's a challenge, but that's what makes historical research so fascinating. We're constantly searching for new clues, new pieces of evidence that can help us fill in the gaps and get a more complete picture.
Well, I'm definitely hooked on this historical mystery. What else can we find?
What about those Amarna letters we touched on earlier? Remember those?
Yeah, those were the messages between the Egyptian pharaoh and the rulers of Canaanite cities.
Oh, right.
And they mentioned attacks by a group called the Habiru.
Yes.
And some scholars think Habiru might be connected to Hebrews.
Right. And if that connection holds up, the timing aligns pretty well with an early Exodus. If the Exodus happened around 1446 BCE, and we add the 40 years of wandering, the Israelites would be arriving in Canaan right around the time those Amarna letters were being written.
So we've got a group causing trouble in Canaan at roughly the right time. Does that seal the deal for Team Early Date?
Not quite. There's a bit of a problem with that theory.
That's it.
The term Habiru appears to have been more of a social designation than a specific ethnic group. They pop up in historical records across a vast area and over a long period of time, which makes it hard to say for sure that they were the Hebrews.
So just because they were shaking things up in Canaan at the right time, it doesn't automatically make them the Israelites.
Exactly. We have to be careful about jumping to conclusions. There's still a lot of debate about who the Habiru were and what their relationship to the Israelites might have been.
It's another piece of the puzzle, but one that needs more context.
Right.
I'm starting to see a pattern here. We've got all these intriguing clues, but each one comes with its own set of questions and uncertainties. It makes me think that maybe this isn't about finding a single right answer.
What are you thinking?
Maybe it's more about appreciating the complexity of the evidence.
Right.
And acknowledging that there's still so much we don't know.
You're absolutely right. And that's what makes historical inquiry so fascinating.
Mm.
It's not always about arriving at a definitive conclusion. It's about exploring the possibilities, grappling with ambiguity, and refining our understanding as new discoveries and interpretations come to light.
Well, my mind is definitely spinning.
Mine too, a little bit.
We've examined the arguments for both a late and an early Exodus.
Yeah.
And I have to say, it's a lot to process.
It is.
Where do we go from here? Where do we even go from here with all these conflicting clues and theories?
Well, maybe it's time to shift gears a bit.
What do you mean?
Instead of getting bogged down in the details of the date, let's explore some broader themes and concepts that might help us understand the Exodus story in a new light.
I'm game. Lead the way.
Okay, so let's step back in time for a moment. Consider the cultural context of the Exodus story.
Okay.
We're talking about events that supposedly took place thousands of years ago in a world that was vastly different from our own.
It's like trying to imagine ourselves in their shoes, walking through ancient cities, experiencing life as they did.
Exactly. And one of the things we have to keep in mind is the nature of slavery in ancient Egypt.
Slavery?
Yeah. Contrary to what we often see in movies and TV shows, slavery in ancient Egypt wasn't always the brutal, dehumanizing system we might imagine.
Really?
Yeah.
I always thought it was pretty straightforward. Slaves were treated terribly.
Well, it's more complicated than that. In some cases, slaves could actually hold positions of authority, own property, and even earn their freedom.
Wait, really? That's not the image I usually get.
It's not, is it? But it's important to understand these nuances if we want to accurately interpret the Exodus story.
Makes sense.
Some scholars believe that the Israelites' enslavement might have been more akin to forced labor on royal projects.
Rather than the stereotypical chains and whips kind of slavery.
It's Jack.
That definitely changes the perspective.
It does. It's a good reminder not to impose our modern day assumptions on the past.
The past is a foreign country, as they say.
It is indeed.
All right, so slavery in ancient Egypt was more complex than we might think. What other cultural factors might be relevant to the Exodus story?
Well, remember how we talked about the religious upheaval during Thutmose III's reign?
Yeah, with the whole Aten thing.
Right, but there was another significant religious shift happening around that time. There was a growing emphasis on personal piety.
Personal piety? What do you mean by that?
It was a move away from the traditional state-sanctioned religion.
Okay.
People were looking for a more individualized approach to faith.
So it's less about following the dictates of the pharaoh and the priests?
Exactly, and more about personal connection with the divine.
Hmm, that's interesting. And how does that tie into the Exodus story?
Well, this shift in religious thinking also had implications for how people viewed the pharaoh.
In what way?
Instead of being seen as a god king, he was increasingly seen as a human intermediary between the people and the gods.
So less divine, more human. I can see where you're going with this. Could this changing religious landscape have influenced the Israelites' own developing beliefs in Yahweh as the one true God?
It's a fascinating possibility, isn't it? The Exodus story, with its emphasis on Yahweh's power and authority, could reflect these broader cultural and religious trends happening in Egypt at the time.
So the Exodus might not have happened in a vacuum, but as part of a larger cultural and religious shift.
That's the idea. It's all about understanding the story within its historical and cultural context.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. So we've got slavery and religious change. Anything else?
Well, what about the role of collective memory?
Collective memory. How does that play into this?
Well, think about it. The Exodus story was likely passed down orally for generations before it was ever written down.
Like stories around a campfire. Tales told from grandparent to grandchild.
Exactly. And think about what happens in a game of telephone.
Oh, I see where you're going with this.
Details can get distorted, embellished.
Or even left out entirely.
Right, as the story is passed along.
So it's like a giant game of historical telephone.
In a way, yes.
But with a story as important as the Exodus, surely they wouldn't have changed too much, right?
Well, it's not necessarily about intentional changes.
Okay.
It's about the natural evolution of a story that's being told and retold over time.
Right.
The process of oral transmission can have a profound impact on how events are remembered and understood.
Okay, so how might this apply to the Exodus specifically?
Well, think about the number 40, which appears repeatedly in the Exodus narrative. 40 years of wandering in the wilderness.
Okay.
40 days Moses spent on Mount Sinai.
Yeah.
40 days of rain during the flood.
It's true. 40 is definitely a recurring theme.
And some scholars believe that 40 might not have been a literal count.
What do you mean?
They think it was more of a symbolic number.
Representing what?
Representing a long but indeterminate period of time.
So it's like saying donkey's years to mean a really long time without specifying exactly how many years.
Precisely. It's about conveying a sense of duration and significance rather than a specific number of years.
That's really interesting. It reminds us that these ancient stories often serve multiple purposes: to entertain, to teach moral lessons, to strengthen group identity, and to connect people to their past.
Exactly. And those purposes might have influenced how the Exodus story was told, retold, and ultimately written down.
Okay, so when we're trying to analyze it for historical accuracy, we need to be mindful of these different layers of meaning.
And the ways in which collective memory might have shaped its content.
It's like trying to separate fact from fiction, but in a way that respects the cultural context of the story.
Exactly. It's a delicate balance.
So what you're saying is, we can't just take everything in the Exodus story literally.
Right. We need to understand the cultural context, the way they viewed time, the way they told stories.
And how all of that might have influenced the way the story was passed down through generations. This is giving me a whole new perspective on how to approach ancient texts and historical records. It's not just about taking everything at face value.
Right.
It's about understanding the cultural context and recognizing that their ways of understanding and recording history might be different from our own.
You're getting it.
Yeah.
And when it comes to the Exodus, this awareness of potential chronological compression and the role of collective memory adds yet another layer of complexity to the dating debate.
It's like a historical onion. Every time we peel back one layer, we find another one underneath.
That's a great way to put it.
And we haven't even gotten to the archaeological evidence related to the root of the Exodus, which you said is a whole other can of worms.
It is. But for now, let's stick with the dating debate.
Okay.
Is there anything else I can share that might help us untangle this chronological knot?
Let me think. We've talked about the biblical texts, the Egyptian records, the Amarna letters, the concept of collective memory. What else is there? What else is there? Oh, what about the whole concept of chronological compression? We talked about how the 480 years in 1 Kings 6.1 could be a sum of figures with overlapping time periods.
Right, similar to the second intermediate period in Egypt.
But the specifics are still unclear.
Yeah, we don't have enough details to really reconstruct the timeline and test that theory.
So even if we set aside the specific numbers for a moment, what can we learn from this idea of chronological compression? What does it tell us about how ancient cultures viewed time?
That's a great question. I think it challenges us to rethink our assumptions about how time was understood and recorded in the ancient world.
Okay, I'm listening.
Our modern obsession with precise linear timelines, with neatly dividing history into centuries and decades, that might not have been shared by those who lived thousands of years ago.
You mean they didn't have calendars and clocks like we do?
They had ways of tracking time, but their focus might have been different.
How so?
They might have been more concerned with conveying the significance of events and the connections between events, rather than sticking to a strict chronological order.
So it's less about pinpointing exact dates and more about understanding the flow of history, the cause and effect, the big picture.
That's it. It's like those family trees where they only list the most important ancestors, even if some generations are missing.
Right. It's more about the key players and the big events than about filling in every single gap.
Exactly. It's about selective inclusion and emphasis, not about giving a blow-by-blow account of every single year.
Yeah, that's a really interesting perspective. It reminds us that we need to approach ancient texts with a bit of cultural sensitivity, recognizing that their methods of understanding and recording the past might be different from our own.
Absolutely. And in the case of the Exodus story, this awareness of potential chronological compression adds yet another layer of nuance to the dating debate.
It highlights the challenges of trying to fit a complex ancient narrative into our modern frameworks of time and historical analysis. It seems like every time we think we've got a handle on this Exodus enigma, another layer of complexity emerges.
It's a bit like peeling an onion.
It is.
Or maybe assembling a jigsaw puzzle with some missing pieces.
It's a mystery that keeps unfolding, revealing new twists and turns with each new discovery.
And that's what keeps us coming back for more.
Speaking of coming back for more, are there any other mind-blowing concepts or interpretations we need to grapple with before wrapping up this Exodus extravaganza?
Well, let's circle back to archaeology one last time.
Okay.
We haven't really delved into the specifics of the Exodus route debate.
Right, where they went, the Red Sea crossing, Mount Sinai, all that.
Exactly. But it's worth noting that the archaeological evidence related to this period, it can be both illuminating and frustratingly inconclusive.
I can only imagine. Trying to find traces of events that happened thousands of years ago, especially in a region as historically layered as the Near East, it must be like trying to find a needle in a haystack.
It's a great analogy. And even when archaeologists uncover something promising, like an ancient settlement or some artifacts, it's not always easy to definitively link them to the Exodus story.
So how do they even begin to piece together the evidence?
It's a process of interpretation, analysis, reevaluation.
Right.
Relying on a combination of physical evidence, textual sources.
And a whole lot of detective work.
You got it.
It's like a historical CSI team.
Kind of, yeah.
Analyzing ancient footprints, searching for clues, trying to reconstruct what happened all those centuries ago.
Exactly. Archaeology rarely offers simple answers, but it provides valuable insights into the past.
It allows us to explore the possibilities.
Even if we can't always say for certain what happened.
All right, I'm starting to embrace the beauty of the unknown when it comes to history.
That's the spirit.
it's not always about finding definitive answers.
Right.
It's about the journey of discovery, the thrill of uncovering new evidence.
Absolutely.
And the realization that our understanding of the past is always evolving. And that's especially true when it comes to the Exodus.
Couldn't agree more.
It sounds like we've covered a lot of ground today, explored a lot of different avenues, and really dug deep into the mysteries surrounding the Exodus.
We have. It's been quite a journey.
It has.
But before we wrap up, I think there's one final perspective we need to consider.
Okay. I'm all ears. What is it?
We've talked about the evidence for both an early and a late beat for the Exodus, right?
We have. We've gone back and forth, weighed the pros and cons, and explored the different interpretations.
Right. And we've seen how complex the issue is.
It's like a tangled web.
It is.
But you're saying there's another way to look at it.
What if the real question isn't about finding the exact year the Exodus occurred?
Whoa, okay. Now you've really got my attention.
Uh-huh.
What are you suggesting?
What if the true significance of the Exodus lies not in its precise chronology, but in its lasting impact on human history and culture?
I've never thought about it that way before.
Think about it for a moment. The Exodus story has resonated with people for thousands of years.
It's true. It's inspired countless works of art, literature, and music.
And it's fueled religious beliefs and social movements across cultures and continents.
Yeah, it's hard to overstate the impact it's had on the world.
And all of that transcends any specific date or location.
You mean whether it happened in the 15th century BCE or the 13th century BCE, or even if it happened differently than the traditional narrative suggests. The core message of the story is what really matters.
Precisely.
The themes of liberation, faith, and resilience.
Those are themes that speak to something deep within us, something universal.
They do. It's like the story taps into the human longing for freedom and dignity.
Exactly.
So you're saying that the true value of the Exodus lies not in its historicity,
but in its enduring legacy.
Right. As a story that speaks to the deepest yearnings of the human heart.
Beautifully put.
And that might be the most important takeaway from our deep dive into the past.
What do you think?
I think you're right. History isn't just about dates and events. It's about the stories we tell ourselves, the values we uphold, and the shared human experiences that connect us across cultures and generations.
Couldn't have said it better myself.
Well, it seems we've reached the end of our Exodus exploration, and I have to say, it's been an incredible journey.
It has. We've covered a lot of ground.
We've uncovered layers of history.
Analyzed ancient texts.
Debated with scholars.
And maybe even come away with more questions than answers.
But that's okay, right? Because sometimes the questions are more important than the answers.
I agree. They keep us curious. They keep us searching. They keep us engaged with the past.
So before we say goodbye, is there one final question, one lingering thought you want to leave our listener with?
Here's something to ponder. How does the Exodus story, with all its complexities and ambiguities, speak to you personally? What resonates with you? What challenges you? And how does this ancient tale inform your own understanding of faith, freedom, and the human search for meaning and purpose?
That's a powerful question to leave our listeners with. It invites them to connect this ancient story to their own lives.
Right.
And to reflect on its enduring relevance in a world that still grapples with issues of oppression, liberation, and the pursuit of a better future.
And who knows, maybe through continued exploration and discovery, we'll uncover new insights that shed further light on the mysteries of the Exodus.
Or maybe the mystery is part of what makes it so captivating.
It could be. After all, the best stories are often the ones that leave us with more questions than answers.
Well, on that note, we'll bid farewell to our listeners.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into the Exodus.
Until next time, keep exploring, keep questioning, and keep the spirit of historical curiosity alive.
And remember, the past is never truly past. It lives on in the stories we tell, the lessons we learn, and the ways we shape our world today.
It's amazing, isn't it?
What is?
How we can go from talking about ancient cities and pharaohs to feeling like we're right there with the Israelites, experiencing their journey.
It's the power of storytelling, I think.
Yeah. And the power of history to connect us to the past in such a visceral way.
It's like those stories become a part of us.
They do.
They shape our understanding of the world, of ourselves, of what it means to be human.
And the Exodus story, with its themes of oppression, liberation, faith, it's a story that continues to resonate with people all over the world.
It does.
It's a story that speaks to our deepest hopes and fears.
Our longing for freedom, our search for meaning.
Exactly. So as we wrap up our deep dive into the Exodus, I'm wondering, what's the one takeaway, the one essential truth that you hope our listeners will carry with them?
That's a good question.
Is there anything in particular?
You know, we've spent a lot of time talking about the dating of the Exodus.
We have.
The evidence for an early date versus a late date, the complexities of the historical record.
Right, and all the different interpretations.
Yeah. But what if the most important thing about the Exodus isn't the when, but the why?
The why.
What if it's not about pinpointing the exact year it happened, but about understanding the enduring power of the story itself?
I like that. The power of the story.
Because let's be honest, whether the Exodus happened exactly as described in the Bible or whether it was a more nuanced, multi-layered event, the core message of the story continues to inspire and challenge us, doesn't it?
It does. It's a story about hope in the face of despair.
About resilience in the face of oppression.
About faith in the face of doubt.
And about the human capacity for transformation and growth.
It's a story that reminds us that even in the darkest of times, there's always the possibility of liberation, of a new beginning.
And that's a message that resonates with people across cultures, across time.
It's a timeless story.
It is.
A story that continues to speak to us today just as powerfully as it did thousands of years ago.
Maybe even more so.
Well said. And on that note, I think it's time for us to say goodbye to our listeners, leaving them with a newfound appreciation for the power of the Exodus story and the enduring relevance of its message.
And with the understanding that history is more than just dates and facts. It's a tapestry woven from stories, beliefs, and experiences that shape who we are and how we see the world.
Beautifully said.
Yeah.
Until next time, keep exploring, keep questioning, and keep the spirit of historical curiosity alive.
And remember, the past is never truly past. It lives on in us, in our stories, in our values, and in the choices we make every day.